Welcome to Reframed. Join us as we explore the concept of redemptive business in our unique context on the African continent.
Hello and welcome to the Big Change Podcast, where we are exploring how ordinary Christians can change their world. My name is Jonathan Wilson and I'm your host. And in today's episode, we're entering the world of venture capital, and specifically venture capital in Africa, a continent that has suffered the legacies of centuries of colonialism. And as we look at that context, there's an outstanding question, which is, has the colonial exploitation of Africa actually ended? And if not, what can investors in particular do about it? So today we're joined not just by a guest, but by my friend and colleague and co-founder in the company Third Way Capital, David Harley. David is the CEO of Third Way Capital, and with him are two partners, one of those being me and the other being Kwabena Owusu-Ejei. Some listeners may have seen him before when he appeared in Ziwani's Call to Work video series. Welcome, David.
Thank you, Jonathan.
If my memory serves me correctly, it was about 2 days before lockdown in Toronto in March of 2020, COVID lockdown, when you had asked me to get together for lunch. And I said, "What's up, David?" And you said, "I want to start an investing company, one that is focused on entrepreneurs in Africa." So how did you get to that point? What got you to decide to start an investing company?
Good question. How far back do you want to go? So I would say the roots of that are certainly in my upbringing in Ghana. I've spent the first 18 years of my life in Ghana, and was just, you know, very apparent to me the lost opportunity in the insistence on the West focusing on aid as the ultimate solution for driving African growth forward. Even for a 14, 15, 16 year old kid, it was pretty obvious. And so it was a little bit of a head scratcher as to why folks that were much more educated and experienced than I were failing to see that you really are limited in building anything sustainable through the mechanism of aid. So fast forward through that, I spent a very, you know, sort of difficult slash painful period of my life in engineering. That's my first half of my career was in engineering, and it's, you know, certainly given me a lot in terms of a problem solving skill set. But my heart's always been, I think, with solving problems a little bit, you know, larger than how to provide cool air to a large healthcare facility, for instance. And so after a 7-year career in engineering, I went overseas, overseas meaning left Canada, to spend a year in Madrid doing my MBA. And this was a tough journey for me to make, because even though I sort of sensed in my previous career that I had skill in the business world and always found things like economics came easily to me, I struggled with the whole purpose of business, being someone of faith. I was really on a journey of trying to reconcile the motivation underlying a career in business. Probably the convergence point for me was I was doing the Camino, El Camino del Santiago de Compostela, which is the way, as they call it in English, through the north of Spain. And you basically walk for about 30 kilometers every day. And I was doing it as a soul searching sort of thing. So I'm in the middle of my program. It's summertime. I'm going to be going back to Madrid in a few days and start applying for jobs. And it just became very clear, you're going to have to do some stuff back home. And it was as vague as that, but it just felt like all of what you're learning, all of the tool set that you're getting through this program, there's a place to use that. And it's back home on the continent of Africa. It still took 2 years after my return for that to really flesh out. Initially, you know, I'd thought about perhaps go work in a private equity shop or, you know, go work in investment banking and build a network base there and then pivot that into what we're doing now. But through a number of voices, people in my life who played mentorship roles in different capacities, what I was hearing was you're not going to learn much in that world that's going to set you up to do this very well, because there's so much that people from that world have to unlearn in thinking about finance and business. And we're having these conversations all the time with people who are of that world. And in some ways, the learning journey is harder for them than it is for folks that come in with a clean slate. Learning journey for folks that are steeped in the financial world is harder. So I'm grateful that we went for it, Jonathan. I certainly called you up that day under the urging of God's Spirit, not knowing at all where you were at in your journey. And maybe you speak that a little bit, but you know, I was really just looking for some wisdom and approached you in an advisory capacity, knowing that you had spent your time developing this big change framework. It made a lot of sense to me that that would fit quite nicely developing a framework to talk about things like impact and change and change at a systemic level. And then finding out that you were very much on a path of your own that would, and that our paths were converging.
That's great, David. That really helps to get a sense of your story and how you got to what you and I and our team are doing at Third Way Capital. And I think we've talked about this a lot. We don't see ourselves as trying to, in a sense, do something that is a rebuke to anyone, but it, that is trying to build a bridge. And you know, this whole podcast series is built around this theme of reconciliation, that God in Jesus is reconciling all things to himself so that the relationships are right and whole and just and contribute to flourishing. And we want a relationship between Global North and Global South that is characterized by that, not in which the Global North relates to the Global South just from a place of guilt or from some place of, you know, historic obligation, but from a proactive, co-creative, leaning in posture. And likewise, that people from the Global South have their rightful place in co-creating a way forward. The other thing I think is worth mentioning, maybe as a bit of a shout out, is that you got your MBA from IE Business School in Madrid, which you found so valuable. And you are an adjunct faculty member at the school. Maybe just say a little bit about what you teach, just in sketch form.
Sure. I teach a course that I've called Distributive Capitalism, Building the New Economy. It was sort of, again, around that, just in around that period of the pandemic and people really reaching for alternative solutions to, you know, what we have now, you know, sort of neoliberal capitalism. It's a course effectively that is all about the pre-distribution of capital, if you like. You know, we have systems that rely on taxation, which is almost a post-distribution of capitalism that doesn't actually transmit wealth. So with pre-distribution, we're talking about things like employee ownership and basically a wider view of capitalism that results in the many as opposed to the few being owners of companies and of wealth in general. So yeah, it's lots of fun. It's an undergrad course. And so I've got students anywhere between 18 to 22 and they're really lean into it. So we've had lots of fun.
What I've really appreciated about what you're studying is that it is really seeking a, I would say, a sound answer to the problem that capitalism can't solve what everybody thinks socialism or communism has been is trying to solve. And yet we know that communism in particular is a failed system. And we know that capitalism actually is workable. It does, it achieves important things. And this addresses its weakness in terms of a more appropriate distribution of wealth. So let's get moving into the core of our discussion today. I think it's helpful for listeners if we start with some basics. Many people know what venture capital is, but many people don't. You and I will be articulating assumptions about what business is for. You mentioned that earlier. What's the purpose of business? But that doesn't mean every listener shares that or knows what our assumptions are. So I thought it'd be good if we start on that and also just a little bit of an exploration around our assumptions around capital and what it's for. So David, how would you describe what is the healthy purpose of a business?
Yeah, I mean, so simply put, to me, businesses are really about people wanting to express their talents, their passions, their abilities in different ways. And under a market environment, a business allows you to be compensated for that. the primary goal for business, for me, the landscape of businesses or marketplace is to allow for human expression, human flourishing. Now, a business allows that to become sustainable in that a business should create profits and allow you to, hey, look, if you are a shoemaker, you get to then invest your profits back into the business and earn a living wage and continue to do what you do. So that, in its simplest terms, to me, is the purpose of business.
I was, you know, you talked about flourishing there, and I thought I was reminded of a passage from the Old Testament in the Bible that I want to go back to, because this vision of flourishing, which you and I think just assume, is not necessarily assumed by everyone. And also, I think a lot of people don't realize that Christian scriptures, including the Old Testament Jewish scriptures, are chock full of this vision of shalom, of flourishing. And there's a text from the Old Testament, it comes from Numbers 24, where a pagan prophet, actually almost like a witch doctor kind of person, is actually, he's trying to curse God's people, in this particular story, the people of Israel. And he can't do it. And he's actually forced to bless them. And he's forced to bless them because wherever God is, there is wholeness. And this is what he says: "How fair are your tents, O Jacob, your encampments, O Israel, like palm groves that stretch far away, like gardens beside a river, like aloes that the Lord has planted, like cedar trees beside the waters. Waters shall flow from his buckets, and his seed shall have abundant water. His king shall be higher than Agag," which was a kingdom of the time, "and his kingdom shall be exalted." And just this beautiful picture of flowing water and growing trees is what God has in mind for his creation and for his people. So I think it's helpful to just to, again, sketch that out a little bit so that people understand. We think business, which can sometimes be seen as very hard-nosed and is just about making money, actually has a role to play in creating this flourishing. So within that, David, what is venture capital? And how is it different from, say, private equity and other types of deployment of capital that people might encounter?
Yes. So, I mean, really, strictly speaking, you know, if you look in the books, venture capital is defined as a subset in the world of private equity. Private equity simply meaning privately owned companies. So venture capital companies ultimately being privately owned themselves, either by the founder or a mix of the founder and investors, would fall in that subset. But private equity in regular parlance has come to mean generally investments in larger or medium to larger companies, often leveraged, companies that are more mature. And by leveraged, I mean often with the use of taking up debt, companies that are more mature, where the investors really betting on improving the efficiency of the company in order to then sell the company and, you know, make his return. And so it's very efficiency driven. And yes, there's some value created there, but there's really, you know, there's really not much room for any blue sky thinking or anything of the sort within regular private equity. Venture capital then is on the other end of the spectrum, where it's companies that are just getting their start. You know, so it's a baby, it's your 2-year-old toddler, let's call it, and are bringing new ideas to the marketplace. Now, that often, almost always involves a level of risk that doesn't fit into, you know, other types of investment quite easily. And so this other category was created, you know, venture, adventure. Those are the images that are meant to be brought to mind when you hear venture capital. It's risk-oriented capital with the mindset being that if it does work, the returns are outsized and therefore will compensate for the increased risk that you're taking. So it really, you know, it takes a certain kind of investor. It takes a different lens on assessing companies than you would take to regular private equity or, you know, your stocks and bonds market and that sort of thing.
And what I think is so helpful in clarifying that for listeners is it helps us get to the center of why you and I are doing what we're doing in Third Way Capital, or why other people who are in venture capital are doing what they're doing, especially in the impact space. Because the whole point of venture capital is it's the context in which problem solving can take place. And that's what we're all about. We're trying to make change happen through the solving of really thorny problems. And for us, particularly in the African continent, And just to give people a bit of color, so that this doesn't sound too abstract, the work that David and I are doing, our company has five key areas of focus. And we're, in a sense, we're trying to solve these kinds of problems. And the first is backing companies that have products or services that they can export to countries outside of Africa and strengthen, you know, local economies, or where they're formalizing what previously was informal so that it can scale and grow more robust. And that would include things like, you know, digitizing particular economies such as supply chain and logistics. We've looked for companies that also bring in imports so that African economies aren't dependent on foreign imports. We look at companies that contribute to the green economy or, you know, climate resilience, which is going to be very important in the future, and private sector social services. So that would be things like health or education. So moving on from that, let's talk a little bit about the function of capital from a Christian mindset. And to do this, I want to go to the book of 2 Corinthians, or the letter that Paul wrote to the community in Corinth many, many centuries ago, similar time to when he would have written the letter of Colossians. So this is from 2 Corinthians 9, 6 to 15. The point is this: the one who sows sparingly will also reap sparingly, and the one who sows bountifully will also reap bountifully. Each of you must give as you have made up your mind, not regretfully or under compulsion, for God loves a cheerful giver. And God is able to provide you with every blessing in abundance, so that by always having enough of everything, you may share abundantly in every good work. As it is written, he scatters abroad, he gives to the poor, his justice endures forever. Now he who supplies seed to the sower and bread for food will supply and multiply your seed for sowing and increase the harvest of your justice. You will be enriched in every way for your great generosity, which will produce thanksgiving to God through us. For the rendering of this service not only supplies the needs of the holy, of Christians, but also overflows with many expressions of gratitude to God. Through the tested proof of this service, you glorify God by your obedience to the testimony of the good news of the Messiah, and by the generosity of your partnership with them and with all others, while they long for you and pray for you because of the surpassing grace of God that he has given you. Thanks be to God for his indescribable gift. So, what I want to pull out from this text that we've just heard is, firstly, that even though Paul is primarily talking here about the giving of financial helps, as opposed to, say, investing in a commercial enterprise, he clearly understands that when we deploy capital, we know that what we're dealing with is a gift. The fact that we have it is a gift, and that allows us to then act with it in a generous manner, a giving manner. And he distinguishes between seed for sowing and bread for food. I think it's really important. This is not my insight or perspective. I was meeting an investor recently who made this point to me. He said, too many investors, especially he was speaking of Christian investors, are looking to see their investment enable them to basically increase the amount of bread on their table, as opposed to treating their investment as seed to generate results. And he was saying, you can trust God to look after you for what's on your table. But if he's given you resources, then your stewardship of those resources is to ensure that they become seed for results. And I think that's really key to David, how we see, you know, our work. And just the other thing that I would add here is Paul keeps referring to the language of partnership. The one giving and the one receiving are not a beggar and a powerful person, they're two partners. And later on, we'll come back to the letter, because clearly he expects that there'll be reciprocity at some stage, that it might have to go in the other direction. There's always a giving and a receiving, and a giving and a receiving, depending on skills, resources, capital, whatever it may be.
Just to jump on that for a second, as you talked about that, there's sort of a parallel analogy to the one on the side of an investor who's expecting a return, but it's really just bread for his table. Is also the way in which we focus then on the other side of things is philanthropy. You know, for a lot of Christian investors, it's about mainstream investments in the market, and then it's philanthropy, which often, again, is bread, is sort of a handout. It's bread for the table for someone who doesn't have. And the seed is really where the gap is in causing things to grow that weren't there before, making things new, so to speak, and participating with God in that.
And I think we've said this before ourselves, but I mean, in a way, it's why we're doing what we're doing. But our conviction is that of anybody in this world's community, Christians are perhaps best positioned, not necessarily from a capital standpoint, but from a philosophy of life standpoint, to participate in venture capital, precisely because it's all about sowing seed in order to see results that are solving problems. And because venture capital is that creative, somewhat often risky space, but it's purpose-driven. It's not just risk for the sake of trying to make a great return. It's purpose-driven. But let's now pull back from these sort of basic definitions that we've just worked through and talk about the function of capital in a world where we actually have distorted relationships, where we have unequal relationships, or we have broken relationships. This is everywhere. It's in the West. It's in the Global South. But we're particularly talking about the African context.
Yeah, and this is obviously a thorny issue for some, because it's not an easy issue to contend with on either side of the argument. The history there is painful on both sides, and I think we're still grappling with that. But certainly there's been work done recently that's showing that the legacy of colonialism remains, that there are still massive inequalities in the distribution of wealth and the movement of capital globally. And here I would reference a study by Jason Hickel, British academic, actually grew up in Eswatini, former Swaziland, and the numbers there are pretty staggering, indicating the gap in outflows and inflows between the global North and South. $2 trillion in aid investment income flows from North to South, which sounds like a lot, but you sense check those numbers with the flows the other way. It's $5 trillion in investment flowing from global South to global North, which immediately should cause us to at least start to ask the question, are things as we think that they are? Because the general narrative is that the South is sort of cup in hand waiting for the North to supply their needs. But the reality on the ground is that the resource movement is actually in the direction of the North. Until you start to grapple with these systemic, deeply systemic issues, it's going to be hard to actually move the needle. And so, yeah, really big conversations to be had within Christian communities and without, reckoning with these legacies of colonialism are going to have to be central to those discussions.
Yeah. And we've seen that not only in the flow of capital, but also in, as I've alluded to earlier, the assumptions about where that capital needs to go or how it needs to be deployed. And, what we see in our world of venture capital, and also you see this in private equity, is that firstly, tech is often the focus of these, especially Western-based investors in Africa, and not really looking at how the market actually functions. You've often said that in Africa, if you want to sell a train, you have to first build and sell train tracks. And, there's all these fancy, sexy tech solutions being imagined for this continent, but there isn't actually the digitized market to take those solutions on. We've also seen often situations where, because venture capital is basically trying to follow a playbook that has been written in Western economies, investors in Africa are looking at deals that most look like what they would be familiar with in the West. And if anything, they're also then looking for, well, where is the market for this opportunity? And too often, the kinds of deals they find are most attractive to, or the market for those businesses is in the West. So either the customers are in the West, or the eventual buyer of that business is in the West. So yeah, it might be financially lucrative that you may actually be able to do something successful. And it's also should be said that just because an African business has a Western customer base, that's not a problem. But if that's the only thing that we're doing, then in the end, what we're actually doing is contributing to that ratio you just talked about, which is where there's a resource drain from the global South to the global North. Now, I think it's these macro systems change, these macro level dynamics, that if we're not attentive to them, we actually accentuating them or extending them, and that's extremely unhelpful.
It's interesting to me that as you know, capitalism has matured, or at least capitalism in the form that we practice it has matured. It's begun to resemble the feudal system that capitalism sought to get away from, in which you have the majority of society, you know, producing on farms in order to live on the farms, but really everything's owned by your aristocrats, your lords, and what have you. And I say feudalism because feudalism is essentially a system of high power versus low power. And so, Jonathan, when you speak about Western or global North investors being able to push out a certain type of product that meets with their view of what should be coming out and then repatriating profits. And the central problem there, in my mind, is we've returned to that. We've returned to a system where 80% of the world effectively works for the other 20% of the world. And again, we're starting to reckon with that now. And we're really only starting to reckon with it because it's actually starting to creep into Western economies now. These gross inequalities are becoming the norm in the West as a part of late-stage capitalism. And so, you know, the pandemic sought to emphasize that, for instance, certain parts of the population were hit so much harder than others because they simply, you know, the gaps were just so large. So yes, absolutely systemic. Unfortunately, you know, in speaking with Christians in general, but certainly Christian investors, I do feel that there is a gap in social thinking and systems thinking.
That brings me back to the text I was reading earlier from the letter Paul wrote to the Corinthians. So this is 2 Corinthians 8:8-15. And I do not say this as a command, but I am, by mentioning the eagerness of others, testing to prove the genuineness of your love. For you know the kind gift of our Lord Jesus Messiah, that though he was rich, yet for your sakes he became poor, so that by his poverty you might become rich. And in this matter, I'm giving my opinion. It is beneficial for you who began in responding to this fundraise last year, not only to do something, but even just to desire to do something. Now, finish doing it so that your eagerness may be matched by completing it according to your means. For if the eagerness is there, the gift is acceptable according to what one has, not according to what one does not have. For I do not mean that there should be relief for others and hardship for you, but rather it's a question of equality between your present abundance and their need, so that their abundance may also supply your need, in order that there may be equality. As it is written, the one who had much did not have too much, and the one who had little did not have too little. This is a widely cited text in churches today, and probably throughout Christian history, used to encourage Christians to give to their local church. That's usually how I've heard it taught. But this is actually speaking to, David, what you're talking about. That use of this part of what Paul's doing is firstly, it's actually not faithful to what he's talking about. He's talking about a fundraise for the poor in a completely other place. So he's raising money in what then was Greece for fellow Christians over in the Middle East, in Palestine, Israel, because they were going through famine. So it's a fundraise for the poor and to help them out. And it's not about giving to your local church. It's just, you cannot use this text this way. There are plenty of other places you can go if that's what you need to do, is to encourage your people to give to the local community. And they should. But that's not what this is about. What I like about what Paul is saying here is this underlying sense that when you start to deploy your capital, you are participating in ensuring that resources are flowing wherever they're needed to account for lack, that they're always being put to work. And he assumes, as I mentioned before, that it will come in the other direction too. He's asking the Corinthians to give into this, and he's doing it so there'll be equality. And then he goes on to say, and it will come in your direction too. I think that's very, very important. And if we applied this to our world and our situation, if you've got, now, of course, there's capital in Africa and there are African Christians who should be deploying their capital. But let's just say we're talking about an American or a British investor that is investing into an African business they're doing it in order to contribute to a dynamic of equality. And there's an assumption that within that dynamic, that there will be a receiving back, in this case, from the African founder, from the African company. And it could be return in venture capital, but I think it's more than that. It's you have now partnered in a work of justice. Paul uses that language of justice two or three times in this letter. And for those who read an English translation where it says righteousness, the word righteousness and justice are identical in the Greek, and they carry the same meaning. So Paul is talking about a system of continuous interdependence, of continuous mutuality, not of the more powerful actor being kind to the weaker actor. This is about everybody being in the same body and serving together with the resources they have. So it's in this very positive, not he's not guilting people. He's inviting them into this very rich dynamic of interdependence. And so as we address this larger question associated with colonial exploitation, we can do it from within that framework, not from within a framework of vindictiveness or retribution. We're focused as Christians on reconciliation.
If you've been enjoying the conversation so far, please share with your friends so that more people can discover how their faith can shape a better world.
But yeah, let's make the shift into talking about a positive and generative deployment of capital that is not extractive, but that is actually building up this mutuality across the globe.
Yeah, I mean, if I could get a little abstract with that for a second, as you talk about mutuality, it's interesting. We think of ourselves as bridge builders in a lot of ways between the South and the North. And there's this analogy that Gilbert Keith Chesterton uses that I found really helpful. If you think about the ancient idea of an archway, very much, you know, built from stones, a Roman archway, and those stones hold the bridge up. And his point is, well, it's quite non-intuitive that there's really, if you're looking at the center of the bridge, there's nothing holding it up. What's actually holding it up is each stone is relying on itself. There's almost a trust built in there that I'm going to push on you and you're going to push on me. And that's how it gets held up. And he holds that up as the ideal vision of what global wealth, global capitalism should look like. And he says, what we actually have is a system of towers. And he makes the analogy with the Tower of Babel. And I think he rightly says towers carry the most risk. And we've seen that in the financial crises that we've experienced in the last couple of decades, is we've got highly concentrated wealth, and that wealth comes with risk. And we won't admit it. We pretend that we have a free market society, but ultimately we have a society where the common man pays when that risk comes to bear. And millions of dollars in tax dollars are extracted to then bail out, you know, banks and large industry. And we're starting to reckon with this, that we're carrying lots of risk in the way that our societies are currently organized. And what we should be trying to pivot towards when we think about inequality, it's about leveling. Yes, it's about, you know, reducing excess, but it's also just a much less risky way to organize society. And that if we're ever going to live with each other, it just does not work to have the levels of wealth inequality that we have now. And so it's almost a natural law. But what I love about the Bible is often the wisdom that it gives us, we see that borne out in nature and in natural things, that God understands the world much better than we do. And we only learn in hindsight.
So in a moment, we're actually going to come back to a very specific type of, you say, flatter wealth distribution, which is employee ownership. But to start with what you and I do, which is as venture capitalists investing in these early growth companies, the small company, or if you extrapolate however many hundreds of thousands or millions of small companies are in a given economy, they are the bedrock of a given economy. Everybody knows that. And yet we put our attention upon the really big, you know, the Apples and the Amazons and the Microsofts of this world. But they are not actually, they're in a way, they're tower-like. And the bridge model applies well to the SME world, which is a whole bunch of healthy small businesses that are tied to their local settings, their local people solving local problems, and they're accountable as well within their local community because often hiring from within their own community. I think it'd be helpful to hear you just articulate a little bit about proximity and the power that it brings and how it counters some of these unhealthy colonial, post-colonial dynamics that we've been talking about.
Yes, I first came into contact with this idea, although I suspect that the instinct is strong in most of us because of how we tend to treat our families and those that we care about when they have problems. But I came across this idea of proximity in the work of Bryan Stevenson, his work in the Equal Justice Initiative, which is anchored around primarily helping those that can't afford legal representation, that often are on death row, get past, you know, deal with their legal cases and sometimes beat the case that they're fighting. It sort of, you know, grew into a larger sort of social justice, human rights movement. And so he's been speaking from this pulpit for a couple of decades now, probably three decades. And always when asked about, you know, what the secret sauce is to actually moving the needle in these areas, he refers to proximity as, you know, a willingness to actually get down in the dirt with those whom we seek to support, uphold, whatever you want to call it. And unfortunately, I think his model tends to be the exception rather than the rule. There's lots of folks, I think, that live with sacrificial posture and mindset. But I think there is a how to live. There is a how to actually being successful if you have that mindset. And it involves, to a large degree, proximity, which involves learning, but also involves transformation. Being able to take on a position built on deep knowledge of the actual daily struggles of those whom we say that we want to get in the trenches with. That transformation, you know, it's mysterious in some ways. There is no way to be prescriptive about what's going to happen if you allow yourself to be in X situation. And it takes a lot of faith and it takes a lot of humility to put yourself in that sort of context. I suppose in some ways, you know, we're trying to do that as well, Jonathan. Certainly physically putting ourselves, you know, yourself moving to South Africa, putting ourselves in the environment in which we work, I think that's critical for sure. And there's a lot of funds that unfortunately are still running sort of from, you know, miles away, doing desktop analysis of potential investments and potential companies without really understanding what the daily struggles of a founder in Kenya, in Nairobi, Kenya, are. So in the ways that we can, we're trying to bring that to bear. Obviously, there's still work to do. And so we're also trying to be humble, keep ourselves honest around, but what more can we do to get closer to the problems that are being sought? But I will say, I do think there's a lot of room for trust as well. You're only ever going to get so close to it. And you know, coming back to that analogy of the bridge is what's holding it together is that trust. And I asked one of our investors, why did you invest in us? You know, when, you know, just trying to wrap my head around what's different about him versus so many conversations that we have. And he said, I fundamentally believe that human beings are the same. And if given the same opportunities, the same results will accrue. And it might sound simple, almost dumb, but I actually have come to believe that that's not true of a lot of, you know, well-meaning investors, well-meaning Christian investors even. And there is the sense that somehow they've got to retain control of the thing, whether that thing is the company or whether that thing is the capital, that this will only work if it's done my way or if I retain control. Where that trust doesn't exist, that reciprocity that you spoke of so beautifully, Jonathan, when you read that verse, that reciprocity also can't happen, can't come to bear. And we can't build that history that then continues to then build the trust. Like you say, trust is like a flower and it builds on, you know, that trust yielding success, which yields more trust and more success. That virtuous cycle hasn't got going at all because folks are still holding things close to their chest that they need to to let go and open their arms and start to trust.
So, you know, growing up in the Yali community in Papua, my, you know, my dad being a missionary there, I saw him model this kind of thing. And I remember him making the comment once, because you would sometimes see missionaries or sometimes tourists come from overseas. And in order to do what they thought was, you know, proximity and to identify the people, the first thing they would do is try and dress in a similar fashion. And of course, the Yali people are near naked. The foreign folk would get shocked because the Yali would come and complain. And they wouldn't understand why this complaint was taking place. It's like, look, but I'm trying to be like you. And they would say, yeah, but you're not like us. We know how you dress. And we know that what you're doing is in your culture immodest. And what my dad would point out is that what the Yali were actually looking for is that you have listened to me, that you have sat with me in my suffering, and that you understand how I think about things and you respect it. That whether you dress like me, whether you live in the same kind of house, that those are secondary, you know, and that can only come from proximity. And like you say, it doesn't mean that my dad is like the Yali, but they now have a relationship of mutuality. And the other thing I wanted to say about him was that I overheard him in an interview say, you know, you've become the missionary God intended you to be the day you realize you cannot succeed in your work unless you're dependent on the people he called you to serve.
That is awesome.
So I think what you're sharing, David, and what I'm sharing from my own background is reinforcing this idea that as investors, we have to respectfully depend upon our founders that we're investing in, even as we also hope they're also going to be listening to us. And we want that relationship. It's going to be one of mutuality. Neither has the power center.
I love that, Jonathan. The thing is, when people hear that, they think, well, that's sort of nice and organic, and but also it's sort of subjective. How do you measure the dependency and what have you? I think one thing that goes a long way is to think about structuring that in. If you create structures that don't work, that actually build in that dependency, all of a sudden you have to. And then one of the things that we did quite early on is we said we wouldn't take majority positions in companies. But ultimately, a majority position, you may have the best of intentions, but it, you know, leads to temptation. All of a sudden, there's some problem that you really want solved, and you're going to step in and be the one to solve it, where now we're in a position where we have to work with the founder to address this problem because he still is, you know, holds the majority of the shares. And that's transformative for us in having to listen to his viewpoints and understand where he might be coming from, whether or not he's right or wrong. He's not trying to fail here. He's trying to succeed. And so, you know, there's lots that gets lost in translation, but I would say between year one and where we are now, which is year 4 or 5, we're probably getting better at it. And we wouldn't be better at it unless we had to get better at it. And we put ourselves in a position where we had to make this work, we had to get better at it. But I don't, again, there's an opportunity there if we want it to say, okay, let's build that, not just us, I mean, the wider community. Let's build that into our structures. Let's impose this requirement for mutuality into our structures so that we, along with our founders, can do the transformative work that's required. It's not saying they're perfect and they know everything either. It's to say we're better together. And if we put ourselves in the position of having to work together, well, that'll be transformative in the long run.
Yeah. And we've seen the fruit. Well, we've seen negative examples of that. And we've seen the fruit of that. A couple of years back, I spoke to somebody in Nairobi in Kenya about a business solution that was being developed in last mile delivery. So this is the delivery of products into what Westerners might call slums or, you know, township type communities. And it was heavily tech based. I believe the founder was an expat, like not a Kenyan. There were Kenyans on the team. The capital came from overseas. The investors believed that they were backing a very important solution, or they were working towards a very important outcome, which they were. But they also believed in the process and the technology. And what they didn't understand was that by deploying a solution that was really coming out of Western sensibilities about how to do venture and how to create a tech-based solution, is that this business was completely undermining pre-existing informal networks that contributed to effective movement of products in those communities. And yet there are examples on this continent of last mile delivery companies that they might use technology. It's tech enabled as opposed to entirely tech based or entirely digital. And they do it in such a way is that it actually leverages and enhances the informal systems that were already there. And so the one is the result of a lack of relationship, a lack of proximity, whereas the other models reflect that deep, you know, awareness of what's actually important, what the local dynamics are, and how to best work with them towards a social change.
Right. And, you know, a lot of this is influenced, Jonathan, by some of the framework that you use on your big change framework that was birthed in your time consulting, that really, if you're seeking systemic outcomes, you have to build into that timelines that reflect that. And so for us, first of all, we looked at the big change that we're trying to bring to bear, and then work that backwards to kind of say, well, what does that look like in the short term, you know, with Jonathan, you term base camp, I believe. And then we have sort of a midterm horizon, which is around 10 years, and then the long term, which is, you know, around 40 years. And I think that's reflective of reality. Lots of research showing that those are the sorts of time scales required to make that change. And again, when you're talking about 40 years, you really, none of us might be around for that. And I think that really, again, forces us to get away from ourselves, and that, if you like, an intrinsic reward of, you know, writing a check for a charity and being able to pat yourself on the back right away, which is nothing wrong with that. But I think if your outcomes are longer and time scaled, then I do think it forces you into a posture of just humility and possibly getting over oneself. But yeah, that absolutely has implications then for how we invest. And we realize, as we talked about, we're building tracks as well as the train, and it just takes longer. We talk about it as systems investing. That's not a term that I've coined, by the way, but it's very apt, because ordinarily, you know, in your American or European venture capital firm, you're really talking about more idiosyncratic investment where the market exists, you're expecting the company to come in and outperform the market. Right. Let's call the market loosely S&P, which is a representation of, you know, a collection of a basket of Western based companies, multinationals. So with systems investing, you're looking at a market that itself is growing and is growing quite significantly. And so Western markets do around 2% a year. We expect, you know, right now Kenya does around 6% a year, or really pre-pandemic, countries like Kenya, Ghana, do around 6% a year, which is impressive in itself, but we're really expecting over the next two decades that will kick up to the low double digits. And so while the companies we invest in, we expect them to grow against the backdrop of a growing market. And so the timescales on that are necessarily longer. And so we emphasize either patient capital or permanent capital. We've got, you know, two different vehicles, one vehicle for each. We've got a holding company that allows a permanent capital approach, where we will be invested in companies for the long term, and there may be opportunities to exit or pull out liquidity in other ways via dividends or what have you. But the real intent is a long haul, where we're going to support the company through whatever it takes to get where it's going. This ethos exists right through all of our investments, but our other vehicle is a patient capital vehicle where, you know, the investors into that and the LPs are expecting some return under some defined timeline, but even those timelines are deliberately pulled out longer. And so whereas the norm in venture capital is 7 to 10 years, we're working with investors towards timelines more in the 12 to 15 year range, because that's really, even looking purely from a financial performance standpoint, that's really where the returns are to be made, not in the first, you know, 7 years, for example. So yeah, that's one of the things that is going to be crucial to seeing this change come to bear. We're unfortunately one of the few that's gone this path, but we do believe, as you know, as groups like ours show results, that there's going to be increasing pressure on LPs, on the world of development finance institutions, to start to think more creatively around how they structure vehicles such that they actually work for the realities of a frontier market as opposed to your plain vanilla vehicle that's really built for a mature financial system.
Yeah, no, that's great, David. I think what's important about what you're saying is we're not saying that these companies are taking a long time to get to scale or in terms of returns because they're weak, but because the market is growing. And we're participating in a systems change, not simply the growth of an individual company. I think that's one thing. The other thing, you didn't say this, but I think it's something we both believe, is that the project itself is just super exciting. We're not trying to build the next most special milkshake, you know, for some consumer in New York. We're actually building the nuts and bolts of the future of this country. We're participating in that. Obviously, we're not doing it all ourselves by any stretch. And then there's the work that we do, you know, or any venture capital company does with, it has to find those companies that you're going to invest in. You have to then make choices. Do we go with them? Do we not go with them? At some point, we sometimes have to tell somebody, no, we're not going to invest in you. We've seen that because this world of venture capital often reveals its true heart, which is it's there to simply extract value as opposed to genuinely create it. A company that doesn't fit an investor's profile that just gets ghosted. You know, the founder was in a nice conversation about potentially getting an investment and suddenly they're not hearing from the investor. You get these kinds of behaviors going on. So I think, yeah, maybe you could talk to that as well. What does it mean to have a process that has its own internal integrity to what we're trying to do in terms of systems change?
Right. Well, you know what? Again, this is one of those things where being proximate has been really helpful because we have to raise capital as well. And so in a sense, we are in that same battle. And, you know, Jonathan, we've been ghosted a number of times, as you know. And so the feeling of that is all too apparent to us. It informs how we work with these companies because we've put ourselves, you know, again, it would be great to be sitting on a $300 million fund post a career in investment banking. But I do really believe the loss for us would have been that sense of proximity and really understanding the day-to-day problems of these companies. We have working capital challenges just like they do, and it informs what we've built and the culture that, right, you know, all the way from the top to the bottom, that we take into pitch sessions with these companies, where we set, you know, timelines around what's possible. And when they change, we're pretty quick to have the conversation with the founder and explain the why, because we understand that that has real life ramifications for their operating line, you know, that needs a certain amount of inputs to keep running and what have you. So I would say a lot of that is stuff that you and I and Kwabna are trying to build into the culture for sure. And then it's easy then for the team, the analyst team, the associate team to follow suit. But I do think we've got the double-edged blessing of being really literally being in the trenches with these companies. And so we understand the pain points of working with a capital environment that doesn't necessarily understand, you know, what we're working with and how we're trying to impact the area that we're trying to impact. So that helps. That's for sure.
I recall, you know, when I was not in what we're doing now, but in my previous career, and went through a number of executive searches, recruiters, you know, approaching me because they thought I might be a fit for their company. And so you're being candidated for an executive position. The search firm is a high, you know, high-end executive search firm. So you'd think that they're going to treat you well because you're candidating for a C-suite position. And yet when, you know, the process would be done and I would only come in second or third, I would have been a good candidate, but not the best. I would say, when this process concludes, if I don't get the job, can I at least, you know, get some feedback or something? And they would take 2 minutes to give me feedback and end that call as quickly as possible because they're on to the next transaction. And I think that kind of transactional mentality really has got to go. And, you know, to our friends who, I think most investors that we work with and know, they do think like we do. But certainly I would encourage people to be expansive, you know, in how you relate to founders and so on. If you got to say no to someone, be clear as to why, give them time and maybe even a bit, you know, half an hour of coaching of just your reflections and observations of the business and give them something to go forward with. And, you know, to go back to what Paul is saying in the letter that we read just now, your generosity to others is in some way, he's not talking karma, but he is saying that things will come back to you too when you need it. So finally, I think we're really getting now down to perhaps one of the more radical elements of what we really passionate about in our work, David. And that is the power of employee ownership models to address this mutuality thing that we've been talking about and to correct some of the gross distortions that come with an unchecked capitalist model. So that's very much your baby. That's what you've been working on. Let's end this episode with hearing about what you've been exploring and what you think its potential is.
Absolutely. Thanks for giving me the plug there to speak about this. So for us, it really was about understanding that, you know, we're working to change some things in the here and now or contribute to that in terms of capital flows and what have you. But also understanding that even in areas of the world where the financial systems are mature and where capital does flow, we see that late stage capitalism is beginning to show us that inequality is almost, it's just an end, a natural end to the incentives that are built into the systems that currently run. You can talk about some of the schools of thinking that have led to this, like Milton Friedman speaking to, you know, shareholder primacy. Ultimately, look, I think stepping back, you know, is this anti-capitalist? I don't believe so. The idea of employee ownership, the idea of distributed ownership, those of us that espouse to those ideas actually believe that this is the natural destiny of capitalism. It's been called Big C capitalism by Louis Kelso, who is sort of one of the chief proponents of employee ownership, which is to say, look, if the project is, you know, move away from feudalism and move towards a system where it's, you know, there are owners of wealth and then the owners of wealth then get return based on what they put in. Well, then really let's emphasize an economy that creates as many owners of wealth as possible. We've done the opposite over the last 200, 300 years where we've emphasized the few owning the wealth. And part of the reason for that, maybe some of it is human greed, but I think some of it is also incidental. It's down to how we've thought about labor in the past. That labor is thought of as an input to production as opposed to simply human capital. So if we can reframe labor as human capital, meaning I go to work and I put in my, you know, 40 hours a week, and that's not just an input, you know, like would be water or grain, it actually has value as capital. Well, then I should be remunerated similarly to how you remunerate someone that invested in the company. And then, you know, where that leads is a system where rather than companies being owned by, you know, your stockholders or even your private owners, you've got companies that are owned at least in part by those that work for them. We see this as potentially the only way that that capitalism can progress without effectively eating itself alive. Capitalism as practiced is kind of a contradiction in to itself because it emphasizes few owners who are incentivized to grow their wealth to as great levels as they can. What that means is then reducing your wages as much as you can, right? Because wages are a cost to your wealth. Once you've got wages down to a certain level, then that reduces demand. And the reduction in demand means that you're going to earn less whatever you're putting out. And so all of what we've done in the past 100 years, offshoring labor to try and reduce those costs and you know, government stimulus to try and create productive activity to so that our tax basis can remain stable, it's all working against a system that's a self-contradiction. And so I believe the need to move away from this is becoming quite apparent. We believe that Africa, as the most nascent of economic grounds, offers the rare opportunity to do this right from the startup, right? To normalize a system. We kind of like to think of it as, you know, the US, as much as there's been a worldwide move away from the class system, the US was really that big experiment, right? Where you had for the first time a country that started as a republic and there was no class. And we've kind of seen that experiment do some great things and we've learned some things from it. The next experiment should be the next opportunity to really make a step change in global political economy is Africa. And it would be a shame if we were to simply import what we've done poorly in the West into these nascent economies. So for us, employee ownership is not a panacea. I'm sure that there may be other systems that we can bring to bear, but it certainly at the moment stands out as one of the highest potential systems that will serve to create economies that are built on not just distributed wealth, but distributed wealth that will continue to redistribute itself because it's underpinned by this mechanism that says, okay, well, you know, you're coming to work for our company. You're getting more than a wage. You're now partaking in the wealth of the company. This hopefully will also shift the incentives of companies because shareholder primacy, again, incentivizes just financial performance. The idea is that with workers having proximity, with workers who actually feel the day-to-day effects of the company because they live in the community in which the company is situated, because they're paid by the company, because they have to have the relationship with the suppliers, they're best placed to act as a regulating entity for a company. And there's a lot of talk now around regulation through ESG measures and all of that to try and get us on the right track in terms of how companies behave and the effect on the environment and ecology and fairness to workers and what have you. My view is that within complex systems, it's very hard to have success in applying regulation because regulation is complicated as opposed to complex. And complexity really requires aligning incentives at the level of the local. So that you can have a real-time reaction when things go south of how they should be going. So there's potential there as well. But it's early stages. There's been progress, certainly in the US and more markedly in the UK in the last decade. There's been a lot of companies that are starting to make these transitions. But again, they're working against the backdrop of a well-settled capitalist system and mentality. Whereas in Africa, it doesn't exist to the same extent. There is an opportunity to embed these ideas quite early on and have them normalized.
And in a context that is already more community or communally, structured than individualistic. And in that way, it seems like a really good fit. And just, we don't need to go into huge detail, but I think one of the things that has also stood out from your research is how, if you only have your business hat on, how effective the performances of companies in terms of productivity and in terms of profitability for companies that have been implementing employee ownership schemes.
Yes. The research is very positive. We're showing 4% increase in productivity, showing reduction in turnovers. These companies survived much better in the last two crises as well, because they can make decisions for the long term, unlike companies that have to respond to quarterly reporting and what have you, that have to make short-term decisions that aren't necessarily good for the people that actually make their day-to-day living at the company and rely on the company for their livelihoods.
Well, David, we have probably used up all our time and more, but this has been such a rich discussion. What I like about where we've ended there is how vividly it brings to life the biblical ideas that we spoke about earlier in the podcast about this mutuality. I'm hoping that listeners have heard both, that this can direct or inform how we behave as individuals, but also, and I think this is quite challenging for maybe particularly Western folk, but maybe not, of thinking of this at a macro level, about this should characterize relationship between East and West, between Global North and Global South, and so on. And we have what it takes to very freely and energetically, implement this thinking at that level.
Thank you so much for having me, Jonathan. And I think the only thing I would add is that it's an opportunity. God is always making things new. He's making things new as we sit right now. And that will happen, whether we like it or not. It's really just a question of which of us wants to get on board with it or not. But yes, the Bible attests to the fact that God's always on the side of the widows and the orphans of this world. And so we can have no question as to where his priorities lie. It's really just a question of to what degree will we align ourselves with his priorities. It's been really good to start to talk there. What's a really, you know, deep and multi-layered issue, and I appreciate the invitation.
Oh, it's been great to have you, David. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode. If you're enjoying this podcast or others that Zawani's released, please rate and review us on your favorite podcast platform, and be sure to come back in 2 weeks for the next episode. We look forward to seeing you then.
Thank you for joining us. This episode of Reframed was brought to you by Zawani, a community of business leaders who partner together to live out their kingdom calling in the marketplace within Africa. Zawani is a Mergon initiative. To know more about us, visit our website at zawani.com. That's ZIWANI.com.